welcome to the Sean L. Show, intimate conversations about music, sex, and life in New York City. I have a feeling my guest today will have a lot to say about all of it. Linda Simpson has been a fixture of New York City nightlife for over 30 years. She is a drag queen, media personality, promoter, photographer, writer, published author, game show hostess, and more. She started the gay revolutionary magazine My Comrade and has published the photo books Pages and Drag Explosion. Welcome to the podcast, Linda Simpson.
Thank you, Sean. How are you today?
I am lovely. It's a beautiful day here in New York and couldn't be happier to have you on. So thank you for doing this. Our icebreaker question for the pod is, what are you listening to? What is in your ears? What's your favorite music right now?
You know what? I've been putting together a lot of Spotify playlists, but I've been trying to sort them kind of by theme. I like 70s and 80s music, so a lot of it's disco, but I've also been doing sort of electronic stuff and also sort of soft rap or soft hip hop. So I've got three playlists going on right now at once.
Oh my goodness, I love that. Well, I will have to follow you on Spotify because I love a Spotify playlist and love curating them myself. Tell our audience that's listening that may not be familiar about Drag Explosion, your gorgeous coffee table book.
Well, it's a collection of photos that I took of New York's drag scene in the 1980s and 90s. I have been for several years doing a slideshow presentation, and it tells the history of the drag explosion back then. And so about a year and a half ago, 2 years ago, a book came out, and I did a collaboration with a guy named David Knowles, who's a publisher and an art director. And he has a small press called Domain. And so we published it, and it's got a great reception. And I'm not a photographer per se, but I took a lot of just for fun photos. And at a time when most people were not carrying around cameras. So I just got a lot of great, like, behind the scenes, kind of insidery shots. And it really sort of charts the history of what went on back then.
Yeah, absolutely. It definitely has a great reception. I had met you at one of your bingo nights and knew that I wanted to have you on the podcast. And then COVID hit and, you know, things got delayed. But I went to go buy your book at Bookmark in the West Village. For those that aren't maybe New Yorkers, it's an adorable little boutique bookstore from Marc Jacobs. And as soon as I told them what I was looking for, because I couldn't find it, they were like, oh, that book, we can't keep it here. Like, it sells out every time we get a restock. And so I had ended up buying it right from Domain. But it certainly is a great sort of guide of that time. And you talk about it being a time when people didn't care much about cameras. And it's so funny because the culture was so different then. We're all on Instagram now and TikTok and caring so much about our image. And, you know, it was a different time because people were less inhibited about having their photos taken, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah, definitely. It's true. I think there was a lot more wild behavior often at the club because, you know, there wasn't anything to, you know, record their naughty actions, supposedly. But besides that, I mean, people just weren't as jaded by cameras. So there was a bit of, I think my photos show a little bit of freshness. They're in color, too. They're all film. And I think they just kind of like are reflective of a moment when people weren't quite as, you know, looking for their best angles necessarily, or, you know, had their like, you know, pouty lip, you know, face down. So it's a little bit more naturalistic in some way.
Right. It's more real. It's more real. You describe in the book that era as being a golden age. Can you sort of take me back there and take the listeners back to what was New York City nightlife like in the 80s and 90s? And what sort of made this era so particularly special?
Well, as I mentioned in the book, too, you know, this is my own personal journey. So I don't want to act like it's the ultimate book about, you know, the New York 80s and 90s nightlife thing, because there was a lot going on back then. But as I see it, Drag was bubbling up in the East Village. Back then, drag was not very popular at all. Like at the straight clubs, the gay clubs, it wasn't understood. It was sort of frowned upon, really. It was looked up as being kind of old and fuddy-duddy, or even perverted, you know, by straight people. Mm-hmm. And so in the 80s, in the East Village scene, drag started becoming very popular in kind of like a refresh, a fresh manner, sort of almost punk rock. You know, they were reinventing drag. And then it gradually spread to the clubs and became a huge nightlife phenomena. Then the media started picking up on it, and a lot of, and then kind of the whole entertainment industry latched on. A lot of it was kind of due to RuPaul becoming a star at that point. So when Ru broke through as a singer with Supermodel, her hit single, there was a lot of interest in the drag scene in general that was going on in New York and everywhere. And so all of a sudden, drag became like this huge cultural phenomena. And I happened to be at the right place at the right time because I was along for this wave, as well as a lot of other people, some who are still, quite active in drag, like RuPaul and Lady Bunny and Lipsinka and, Flotilla, DeBarge, others included. And so it really was just this drag phenomena that eventually ended. It eventually ended. And even Ru's career went on hiatus until she started Drag Race, about a decade later, and, really revived the whole drag queen movement.
Yeah, absolutely. Did you have a sense at the time that it was happening that it was a special moment, or is it more like in retrospect when you look back, you're like, that was it, like that was the moment? Like, what did it feel like at the time?
At the time, it was very exciting just because there was so much going on. I mean, there was a lot of nightlife. So I was working the nightlife, but I was going out a lot too. And the scene was very vast. There were there were a lot of bars, in the East Village, but there were the big clubs too, like the Palladium and the Roxy and the Limelight and the Tunnel and Sound Factory and you name it. So there was just a lot to see and do. And at the same time, as mentioned, as drag was becoming more and more popular, there were just like a lot of job and gig opportunities. And talk shows wanted drag queens, music videos wanted drag queens, mainstream movies started doing drag themes. So there was just a lot of, opportunities. At the time, I was just so kind of caught up in it. I just, in a way, took it for granted. I mean, of course, I was enjoying it, but it wasn't until I was divorced for it for a while, some time had to pass, that I realized, how incredible that whole period of time had been.
Yeah. You moved to New York City from Minnesota, originally from Minnesota. What did you come to New York seeking? Like, did you have something in mind when you headed here, or was it kind of like the gay thing that we all do, that it's like, I just need to get there, I just need to be around more queer people? Like, what was in your head, in your heart, when you were exiting Minnesota, headed for the big city?
Well, I think that exactly what you just said. I didn't really have a career or a plan necessarily. I just knew I wanted to be in New York. I had always been really fascinated with the city. And so I came for college and eventually dropped out, but I just knew that I wanted to be in New York. Things were so much different then. It was like, you could really move to New York, even without college, and it was cheaper, it was more accessible. And so people of all stripes could move here. You didn't have to be like a zillionaire to, afford to live in Manhattan. And, also, it just wasn't as careerist. Now I think because things are tighter economically, you just have got to have like a more of a plan of action. Certainly, and like as mentioned, drag, was not even on my radar back then. I mean, I knew I liked some elements of drag, like Divine or the Warhol Superstars and stuff. But drag, as mentioned, wasn't popular. It wasn't until I was in New York for a while, until like, you know, the mid 80s that I began discovering the East Village scene. And then like, you know, by the late 80s, I had, you know, joined the drag scene itself. So, you know, when I moved here, it was sort of for different reasons than what actually kind of like came about.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. Was there a sense at any point in the midst of everything that we see in the book that you think to yourself, like, this is actually it? This is why I moved here. I'm asking because I've been in New York about 7 years now, and I'm always striving for something. I'm always setting goals and trying to get to the next level financially or the next level in a career or creatively. And it just recently has occurred to me after, I can't say after COVID because we're sort of still in the midst of it, but in this time frame, like maybe the thing that I'm looking for is already here. Like I have this sense that I need to slow down and look around. Maybe this is what I move for. Like I'm already in it. Did you have a sense at that time that you were in sort of the thing that you move for? Does that make sense?
I think that when anyone moves to New York, there's always a little bit of that feeling like, oh, I just missed something, you know? So you're kind of like, you've come in on the tail end of like some scene or some trend or some, you know,
extraordinary
moment in New York's life, when in fact they're always happening, you know, it's like new occurrence after new occurrence after, you know, so you can't judge it in that standard, I think. But I think ultimately what I was really looking for, and maybe not, didn't even realize it at the time, but I found it was just like kind of like a tribe of people, you know, a social circle that really got me, you know. I mean, I had certainly friends before and like, you know, hung out with a lot of people, but it wasn't until I think I really became involved with the drag scene that I really became extremely close with a lot of people of a very similar sensibility. You know, many of them who I'm still, you know, very close to today, most of the people in my photo book, The Drag Explosion, I knew, and I still know them. I wasn't like a paparazzi running around. These were like photos of people, you know, who I considered to be friends or at least friendly with. So I think that was kind of like, you know, the ultimate reward, you know, that came out all this.
Yeah. It's so funny that you do describe it as like having just missed something. Like, I think I have this sense of always feeling like no matter how cool my life is, there's always like something that I'm missing, or like that is so very New York. I don't know if that's unique to the gay scene or if everyone here sort of feels like that, but there's such an energy all the time. And I think that is so funny. There are a lot of very hot men in this book, I have to say. What was your love life like at that time? What are like some of your great memories from that time?
Well, I mean, there are, yeah, in addition, well, I should say that not everyone in my book, even though it's called The Drag Explosion, identified as a drag queen. I mean, there, as you mentioned, there's a lot of like guys in it too, or, and there's a lot of trans people too. So, you know, the trans umbrella was just as wide back then as it is now. But it was a sexy time. I mean, you know, it was a very difficult time in many ways because AIDS, you know, a lot of, all of my photos, I think, were during the, you know, the peak of the AIDS epidemic. So it was a difficult time in many ways. Sex was sort of looked at as being, you know, taboo or frightening. But at the same time, you know, there was a lot of safe sex and, you know, there was a lot of ways of negotiating this, you know, very charged environment. I mean, granted, I was, you know, a lot younger. So it was kind of like a more sexually fueled time in my life, no matter what. But I liked the, you know, including, I mean, I thought it was important to include these guys, of course, these sexy guys in the book, because they were very, you know, a vital part. We all had like, you know, we all played our roles, you know, whether or not you were giving kind of a sexy quality to it or more flamboyant quality. And, you know, it all just kind of rolled up into one. As for the details of my sex life, I don't know about each and every one of my encounters, Sean.
Are any of them particularly memorable and stick out?
Well, I mean, no pun intended. I think that what was interesting to me, and I think maybe a lot of drag queens will tell you this even to this day, is that, you know, many of us get into drag just for the fun of it, you know, the excitement, the action, the performance, you know, aspects. But what you discover is that there is a, you know, sexuality involved, and that there are quite a few men out there that are attracted to drag, trans, you know, gender bending, whatever. So it comes sort of like, you know, it's a bigger package than you think it might be, and that there's a sexual aspect to it also. I mean, some queens follow up on this, some don't, but it is very interesting to all of a sudden be treated sort of like as a, you know, female-ish sexual object.
Right, right. You talk about the time of the AIDS crisis, which really is documented in the book, which I think is very interesting because the book is all joyous, which I love. Like, the book references the time of the AIDS crisis, but it's highlighting still the joy in our community, which touches me because it shows like our unrelenting sort of uncompromising joy. Like, as a community, we're not going to let literally anything sort of take us out. And you talk about it sexually as you know, being a time of negotiation. Was there, because gay men are so horny, what was it like at that time trying to figure out and navigate that? Was it like, have you been tested? Did it raise the stakes almost because every sexual encounter, the stakes were so high?
Well, it did. I mean, you know, yes, there was a lot of anxiety, of course. But, you know, there was a lot of campaigning then for safe sex.
Yeah.
And, you know, condom use especially. So, you know, if you managed to kind of like stay within those, like, you know, safe parameters, you could, you know, be pretty assured that, you know, you wouldn't have to catch anything, or including AIDS. So you know, it was still a very sexual time, but it was, you know, there was a big asterisk. You had to really be careful in what you did. And I think that it did not deny like a sexual energy, but in terms of like, you know, navigating it on an individual basis, you really did have to use some caution and be careful.
Yeah, I honed in on the word negotiation because I just heard Dan Savage talking about it, about that time, and was saying that, like, whether you were in a monogamous relationship, like, a lot of couples would have this sort of agreement that, like, if they cheated, it wasn't a deal breaker because they had to, like, they wanted to know, like, you have to tell me because we have to get tested. Like, it was a different time, and it was like a different negotiation. So when you referenced negotiation, it sort of brought that forth that, like, the conversations were so important at that time. And you also talk in the book about the AIDS crisis and all of the stress of that sort of leading to the birth of your magazine, My Comrade. Can you talk more about that?
Well, it was, you know, the book, as you mentioned, is joyous in many ways, but it was a gloom and doom time. There was a lot, you know, I mean, there was a relentless barrage of bad news for gay people. I mean, not just AIDS, but there was a real huge homophobic backlash from mainstream America and, you know, the powers that be. So, you know, to make matters worse, besides gay people, like, dying en masse, you know, there was no, like, sympathy or care that was coming too. So I was very inspired by like some people, gay people, that started like, you know, being fighting back against this and being, activist minded. And so my artistic response was to start a magazine. I called it My Comrade, just to have kind of like a revolutionary, you know, flair, sort of tongue in cheek. But also I wanted to convey a sense of camaraderie because that's what I thought was really needed at that time. So, it, you know, the main themes were like love, gay power, gay unity. And then it just, I plugged into that drag queen scene in the East Village that I was becoming familiar with because they seemed, you know, very heroic and very like, defiant at that time, just because when they were doing drag at a time when it was not very accepted. And then I incorporated sexy guys too. I mean, the magazine was like, you know, an underground zine. It was like a mishmash of like black and white articles and photos. But it was stylish too, and I think it really was kind of helpful and inspirational to a lot of people just because it brought people together and, you know, let others know that we were all in this together and going to, you know, get through this mess one way or the other.
Yeah, definitely. I think that's so cool. And did I hear that you're developing another book based on the magazine that's coming shortly or...?
Yeah, I do plan on that. I had an exhibit about My Comrade magazine this summer, and it just made me realize too what a, you know, I do have a lot of material from the magazine. I don't think I would do it as a complete anthology, like every single page, but I'd like to highlight pages and photos perhaps that didn't appear in the magazine, like outtakes and like, you know, behind the scenes stuff. But yes, that is a plan.
I love that. I feel very thankful for like these sort of collections of our history because I think about myself being gay now and it's not hard per se. I mean, there's challenges to every aspect of every life, but I have put myself into New York City, surrounded myself by other queer people, liberals, allies. And so the challenge of it is sort of taken away. And I sometimes forget, you know, what it's like in other parts of the world or even other parts of this country that are as close as driving distance, unfortunately, from where we are. Because I, you know, we're in a different time, but even in New York City, in the time that's documented in this book, this was sort of a war. Like you guys were doing acts of courage by going out in the East Village and dressing in drag and being part of the counterculture. And it was that courage that makes it easy for me to go out in sequins and eyeshadow if I want to, or whatever it is for pride. And so I just appreciate that so much. And it just, I love to revel in it. I you know, drank in every page of that book with such delight. So if there's more to come, I would love that. Because I knew about your exhibit and I didn't make it because I was working. Ugh, day jobs are so gross, especially when you have them at night as well. But
get your priorities straight, Sean.
I know. I should have called out. Oh, my goodness. You also developed your own party at that time called Channel 69. Can you tell us about that?
Well, the Channel 69 was at the Pyramid Club, which still exists on Avenue A. And that was the headquarters throughout the 80s for like the kooky East Village drag scene. So it seemed kind of natural when I started doing drag to approach the Pyramid to do a party there. I mean, that seemed to be, you know, the place that was, you know, worked with my sensibility. At the time, the Pyramid was kind of at a low ebb. It had lost a lot of its oomph. Many of the people that had been involved with the Pyramid had moved on for one reason or another. So it was a little bit of, you know, an uphill battle, but the party was a success, and it was a combination of some people that had already been involved with the drag scene before, like Bunny and Taboo and Rue, etc. And then a lot of newcomers too, like Mistress Formica and Sweetie and Aphrodite. And so it was sort of like this ensemble that was involved. And so we would do shows. The Pyramid has a stage. So we would do shows every Wednesday night. It really was a great unifier. This is at the same time I was doing my magazine. So it also had that, you know, a feeling of camaraderie. And it helped put me on the map too, just because it was, you know, a party that got a lot of attention. And so from there, I was asked by other clubs and promoters, et cetera, to host and produce parties. So it kind of like, you know, got my nightlife career going.
I love that. Do you ever think about bringing it back for like a limited run or?
No, not really. Just because I don't know what's, I mean, first of all, like, you know, so many of the players aren't in New York anymore for one way, you know. And then also the Pyramid Club is not where I'd want to do it. I have a chapter actually, or not a chapter, but a section in the Drag Explosion that's all pictures from the dressing room at the Pyramid, you know, behind the scenes. And the dressing room doesn't even exist anymore. I think they use it as storage. So it just would be a little, I don't know, it just wouldn't be the same. It just wouldn't be, I think, as appropriate to do it there. I mean, Channel 69 was great, but I don't think there's any reason to revive it at this point.
Yeah, it's a moment in time, exactly. As they say. So you talk about like when you arrived in New York City, what the drag scene was like in the 1980s and how it really was not the way we think of it today. Like it was sort of seen as like a passe. It wasn't celebrated in the gay community the way it is now. And you mentioned that a little earlier here as well. Do you think that the HIV and AIDS crisis led to sort of the resurgence because people needed more joy and more like an alternate outlet that wasn't so serious? Because there's an essence in the book of like people in this book feel so free. Like it looks like so much fun and it feels like a release. Do you think that those things had anything to do with one another?
Yeah, no, I think your observation is good. I think that that is one of the reasons that not only drag, but just the whole nightlife scene in general really was going so strong because it was escapism. You know, such a harsh time that people needed outlets to have fun because, you know, real life had so many grim moments. So I think that drag queens themselves helped fill that that need for joy, and the club scene at large with its, you know, DJs and go-go dancers and, you know, promoters and all the personalities that were involved were all kind of like this, you know, collective force that helped, entertain people at that time.
Very. Our entertainers are always, I think, at the forefront of any crisis and always more important than we maybe give them credit, whether it's drag queens or anyone. Honestly, I think that, you know, they really are foundational to society. You talk in the book, we see RuPaul a ton throughout the book, and you talk about how Supermodel changed the trajectory of drag in mainstream culture. What was that moment like? I know for myself, as like a little kid, the first drag queens I probably saw were in Gloria Estefan's Everlasting Love video because she was pregnant at the time. And so all the Gloria Estefans in the video are drag queens. And that's sort of a year or two after Rue's song. So can you talk about that time and like feeling that shift from being like counterculture to like sort of thrust into the mainstream in the early 90s?
Well, it was a bit of a slow burn. I mean, before RuPaul became famous, drag was sort of becoming very ingrained and kind of like in kind of a lot of cutting edge stuff, like designers like Terry Mugler and Tuttle using drag queens on the runway, and you know, some avant-garde bands were using drag queens in their music videos. And there were, you know, magazine articles and, you know, some sort of like scholarly books that were looking at drag. So, you know, there was sort of this interest in drag among kind of like, you know, more artsy, edgy kind of happenings. But it was, but when Rue became, you know, I mean, Rue kind of came out of nowhere in some ways. So when she became a pop star, that's when the attention, you know, was focused on the drag scene at large. And it was, you know, quite developed at that time. But, you know, media was so different back then. You know, we didn't have the internet. And so it was really, you know, trends and new stuff was really dependent upon, like, you know, magazines or TV shows, newspapers, declaring something hot. So, right. You know, there were these kind of like gatekeepers that would decide. And so all of a sudden they decided that drag was this, you know, new thing, even though it had been, you know, of course, in existence for many years. So all of a sudden, you know, like as mentioned, there was all this attention. And it was kind of, it was interesting because it was sort of a collective thing. I mean, like Rue got the lion's share of the attention. I mean, you know, rightly so, but a lot of other individuals were like profiled, but it was also more kind of like just about the scene. It just became bigger, bigger and bigger. But that's why also why the drag scene died in many ways. It was too pronged. It's because like the nightlife was very decimated by Mayor Giuliani's law and order crackdown, which included the clubs. So all of a sudden the clubs started closing, you know, nightlife shrunk. Which meant, you know, fewer jobs, drag queens didn't have, you know, places to work. So in New York City, that's a specific thing that happened. And then in general, like I said, the media was different then, and they kind of like got tired of drag. They decreed it as a trend and lost interest in it and didn't do any more coverage. And back then you did not have the internet, so you couldn't keep your own fame or your own
momentum
going. Yeah. So it really, so drag became, you know, I thought that drag had entered, had gotten so popular that it was going to be just kind of this new kind of showbiz staple, but that wasn't the case. It really did, you know, fade and go out of style, including Rue.
Yeah. This Mayor Giuliani that you talk about, he sounds like an asshole. I wonder whatever happened to him in history.
Right.
Talking about Rue, like then and now, was it apparent then that Rue would become the person that we all know now? Like, did it feel, because there's, you were surrounded by so many like talented people that were doing their own thing. Was there a sense like, oh, that one is standing out a little bit? Was her personality back then like, watch out, I'm about to be this pop star? Or did it kind of, like you say, come out of nowhere? What was the vibe back then?
I mean, I should say, I mean, Rue, you know, was always special. I mean, she always stood out. I mean, you know, literally, she's tall, she's gorgeous. Right. You know, she always had something about herself. You know, and Rue experimented with a lot of like different looks and kind of personas. And, you know, she was ambitious, but, you know, I think that she didn't quite know exactly how she was going to break through. It was, you know, only until she started kind of like really concentrating on like, you know, this glam persona, this glamazon persona, that she, you know, figured out something that would be acceptable to mainstream society, because, you know, it was this beautiful image. So I don't know if I would have guessed. I mean, I certainly would have, you know, it would have been hard for anyone to fathom, you know, that Rue had become, would Rue go on to such incredible heights that she has. But I mean, I guess if I, you know, had been back, you know, if I'd been asked back then, who did I think would become, you know, who would break through, I guess I would have, you know, RuPaul certainly would have been among them. Back then, I don't think, like, you know, like I said, many of us, we weren't very careerist. There wasn't that many people you could go with drag. I mean, even despite this, I mean, the drag explosion thing, the media attention gave people hope and like excitement that they were, you know, maybe could become, you know, pop personalities. But it was all kind of vague too, you know? Rue had, you know, a specific path with her, you know, singing and her, you know, her pop hit.
What do you think of where drag is now, largely at the catalyst of Rue and this show that has 1,700 iterations across every nation in the world? I can't even keep up with all of the seasons. Like, my friends are love it, and some of them watch all of them, and I'm like, I didn't even know there was a Drag Race Holland, or there's so many. But what do you think of, like, where it is now compared to then, and like the do you think it's all positive, or do you think it loses something by being sort of mainstream now? What's your hot take on it? What's your read on it?
Well, I think it's all for the good. Yeah. I mean, drag is mostly showbiz. And so there's more job opportunities for people. I think that's great. And I, you know, for a lot of people, you know, whenever you watch the first episode of a new season of RuPaul's Drag Race, you know, you can tell people are very eager to be on the show, because I see it, not just the attention, but I think they see it as, you know, their golden ticket, you know, for to get, you know, improve their lot in lives. And so anyways, I've seen that it's kind of like, you know, very capitalistic now, you know? But I don't think any of that's bad, that like showbiz has embraced drag. I mean, it's still really very dominated by RuPaul's Drag Race. I'm kind of surprised that drag hasn't broke out into different fields more than it has. I mean, granted, I realize, you know, drag queens are doing a lot now, but you know, TV is such a copycat industry. I'm surprised that there's not more drag themed shows, even competitive, you know, even competitive shows. And so I applaud, you know, RuPaul's Drag Race for opening the, allowing more opportunities for people. I mean, I think what's lost is, you know, drag, you know, there's something fun to be said about being in like something that's kind of underground and, you know, insidery club kind of thing. And I'll, you know, I'm really grateful that I got to experience that. But, you know, those things can only exist for so long, or, you know, attract that many people. So it's, you know, better that the doors have widened and more people are able to partake.
Yeah, I think there will be more copycat things. I think that it just takes a little bit longer because it is coming from the counterculture. But I think eventually they'll catch on, like, hey, this is making a lot of money. I think I agree with you. I think what comes out of it is career opportunities. And I think what I hope for the queens that do go on that show, because a lot of them are so young, is that they understand that it's a platform. Like, it's framed as a competition, right? So you're competing to win the thing, but it's really a platform. Like, you're there to show your talent, and then what you make of that platform after, how you spin that into more dollars and more career opportunities, that's actually what you're there for. The winning the show has nothing to do with it. Like, there's been winners that people will remember forever, and then there's been winners that people probably can't name. It's similar to like American Idol or any of those singing competitions. And I think that they get too in their head about the literal competition, that they don't see the trees through the forest, that like, that's actually not the point. Like, it's a platform. But it's funny because we have these New York queens that'll get on the show, and then you'll go to their shows after, and it's filled with like NYU kids, and they're all like straight females, and you're like, wait a minute, this is not the pieces I was at last night. Like, what is going on here? So it's funny because it kind of invites the heterosexual community into our spaces in a way that's interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, I mean, it is. It's amazing that drag has really expanded beyond its, you know, gay base.
Who were some of the celebrities that you remember being part of the scene at that time? Lady Bunny did the foreword to the book, And it's so beautiful. And she talks about like getting pieces of drag from Pat Field's shop, which we know Pat Field's goes on to be, you know, legendary in fashion for Sex and the City and many, many, many other credits after that. Who are some of the people, whether they were names at the time or became huge names after, that you remember sort of like intermingling with at those times?
Well, let's see, I'm trying to think. I mean, it wasn't as, I wouldn't say the scene was as celebrity based then, you know, in the, I mean, occasionally, you know, you would see a celeb of some sort. Like, you know, I think there were designers, like, you know, Terry Mugler, I mentioned, or I don't know who else was among them, Todd Oldham, but I can't think of a lot of like, you know, huge big name celebrities mingling. Like I said, it was sort of like an underground scene, you know?
Yeah.
Pedro Almodovar, the filmmaker, you know, was at a party, I remember. I don't know. I'm not giving a very good answer for this, but some of the people, you know, besides Rue, who were involved with that scene, did go on to success. I mean, you know, Zaldi, who makes all RuPaul's outfits now, was a drag queen back in the era. I don't have any pictures of Zaldi in the book, but Zaldi was, you know, very involved with the scene back at that time. I mean, Bunny, of course, you know, I think she's not a RuPaul Drag Race regular, but they bring her up so often in conversation on the show, and she becomes like a punchline that she's, you know, benefited from all that. So I'm trying to think, you know, I'm sorry, I should have a better answer for you.
That's okay. I didn't prepare you for that question. So it's okay.
How dare you, Sean, ask a question that I might not be prepared for.
No, that's totally fine. What did the period of time between you mark it as about 1996 in the book, and I do not know what year Drag Race started, which is maybe sort of the renaissance, the re-kickoff. Maybe it was a little bit sooner. Maybe it's 2011 or a little bit later. But what did the period between those, that time feel like? The sort of the lull, because you work consistently throughout that. You talk about Rue having a hiatus at that time. What was the vibe that, like, you rode this huge wave and it sort of crashed, and because there was no internet, like you said. So it was like you couldn't keep your own momentum going. Like, the media outlets, the few of them, really controlled, like, this is hot, this is passé. What did that timeline feel like?
Well, I mean, post-drag explosion, I mean, there was certainly a lot of stuff still going on. Yeah. I mean, the annual drag festival that Lady Bunny used to do called Wigstock went on until 2001. And there were, you know, still quite a few drag developments. Hedwig, the movie, came out.
Yes.
Among other things. So it wasn't like drag, you know, just rolled over and died, but it didn't have quite that, you know, huge momentum that had occurred in the earlier part of the decade. I would say one of the things that was a little frustrating during that time is that there wasn't that as much of an influx of new blood. So it was relying sort of on me and some other people that had been around for a while. I mean, not that there was anything wrong with that, but there weren't a lot of people joining the scene. And, you know, for a scene to be fresh, you always kind of like need a new influx of people. And so when Drag Race started, that's when, like, you know, everybody and their brother, you know, put on a wig. But yeah, for a while it was like it was a bit I think lacking in new energy. If I'm, you know, I mean I can really point to 1,000 examples that would prove me wrong. But at the same time, I think that was the generalness, you know, at least as to how I'm remembering.
Yeah, yeah. What sort of advice? So I've shared with some folks in my circle, I talked about Spotify playlists. I love making Spotify playlists. I've decided at this time in my life that I would like to become a DJ.
Okay.
I think I may have missed my calling all along. So I'm teaching myself to DJ And what advice do you have for someone that is in New York City and wanting to join the nightlife scene? What are like some wisdom pearls for whether it's myself trying to do it in a DJ capacity or aspiring drag queens or party promoters, or what advice do you have?
Well, gee whiz. I say, you know, I mean, my attitude, which I hope is somewhat naturalistic, was just to be friendly to everybody. You know, you never know, you know, which patron or, you know, which manager, which barback, for God's sakes, is going to go on to something else that can, like, you know, put a good word in for you or help you or wants you to all of a sudden, like, you know, be involved in their party. But I think that's part of nightlife too. I mean, part of nightlife can be kind of like snobby and competitive and, you know, sort of cutthroat. I always feel it's just better to be, like, you know, friendly, upbeat, and, you know, like we're all in this together.
Right.
You know? So I think that's sort of a, if you can take that attitude and you seem like a friendly guy, Sean, I think that will.
Thank you.
But I think too, I don't know, but I think you've got to find a niche also, you know, just because right now the Manhattan, you know, there's a Manhattan, I mean, there's a Hell's Kitchen scene, there's a West Village scene, there's a, you know, a huge Brooklyn scene. So I guess, you know, you've got to sort of like put your allegiance to one of them or another. Not that you might not be able to, like, you know, move in different circles, but I think that helps too, and helps you kind of get a core crowd also.
Yeah. One of my final questions here, how do you see the scene now versus then? Like, does it feel like it's having a resurgence? Like, which, what do you, how do you view the scene now? Like, which
you mean
is better?
The nightlife scene or the drag?
Yeah, like the nightlife scene.
Well, I'm not as involved with it now, so I can't talk with as, you know, much expertise, but I'm an armchair watcher. I think it's armchair watcher. Is that the expression?
I knew what you meant. I knew what you meant.
Armchair observer, maybe. I don't know. I mean, like, back in the day, like I mentioned, it was much more big club oriented. Now it's more bars or, you know, smaller clubs. I'm constantly amazed when I go into Brooklyn, you know, on a rare occasion, and see how much energy and how many participants there are out there. I find that very interesting. I live in Hell's Kitchen, but I'm not as familiar with the scene. Certainly for drag, there's a lot more opportunities. I feel like every bar and every club offers, you know, drag now. In fact, I kind of feel like it's a little overdone, to tell you the truth. I hate to say that. But I really feel like some bars and clubs rely a little too much on drags, when they could just rely on drugs. No, when they could just,
right.
they could just rely on being kind of a fun place, you know?
Right.
So that's my, you know, not very insightful take on nightlife. But I feel also, like, you know, you've always got to just take advantage of what you've got, you know? You can't pine for the past or, you know, wonder about what's going to happen eventually. You know, you just got to seize the moment. And honestly, in a decade, you'll look back and say, wow, that was the funnest time I ever had. So, you know, a lot of keeping things in perspective.
Right, exactly. This was such a wonderful conversation. Thank you so much for being here and having this chat with me. I hope that you'll come back sometime and chat some more. Tell us, you know, plug away. The book is called The Drag Explosion. And where else can we find you?
Well, if you're specifically interested in The Drag Explosion, there's a website, thedragexplosion.com. And it has samples of my photos. And also explains how you can get my book if you're interested. And also, I'm active on Instagram, Linda Simpson. And that's probably, you know, the two places that you could look to find me the best.
Perfect. That's perfect.
Can I ask one question before we go, Sean?
Of course, I would love it.
Where are you from originally?
I am from a little town northwest of Hartford called Simsbury, Connecticut.
I see. Okay. And then did you come to New York just because you wanted to live in New York?
I came to New York because it seemed like where all the gay people were. So it just seemed like, you know, glitz and glamour. And, you know, my parents aren't really like into cities. They grew up in Hartford. So their aspiration was to get out of a city. And Hartford's, you know, not, it was nice when they grew up, but it's not nice now. And so their dream was like the suburbs. And so growing up, I was like always drawn to New York City. It was rare that we would come here because they didn't really like it. It was too much for them. And I was like, this is... It was like feeling plugged into an energy. And so I just always wanted to be here. And I knew I wanted to work in entertainment, got a degree in music management. I didn't end up working in that at all. But I found my way back to entertainment through this podcast and now maybe back to music through DJing and playlisting. So, yeah, that's sort of my trajectory.
Fantastic. And where do you live in New York?
I am in Astoria, Queens. So we talked about different scenes. So maybe my niche is creating the Astoria scene because there isn't really one. We have a few clubs out here, but they're not particularly like, you know, they're not the hot thing that everyone's talking about. So maybe I can create that. I don't know. We'll see.
Right. We found something for you to do finally.
Yeah. put me to work. Make me useful. Yeah. Yes.
Well, thanks a lot for having me on your podcast, Sean. I really appreciate it.
Oh my gosh, it was so fun. I'm so glad I got to talk about this time with you. And I definitely want you to come back for the next book or anytime you want to talk. You just hit me up and we'll have you on.
Sounds great.
Thank you all for listening. You can find me on Instagram at Sean L. Show. Give us 5 stars wherever you're listening and tune in next time. Bye-bye.